As a warning, this episode includes descriptions of violent acts. Please be advised.
In episode one, we heard the story of the Union County Jail Raid Massacre. It was a horrific incident in early 1871, where a dozen black members of the South Carolina militia were sent to the Union County Jail for the death of a white bootlegger. Hundreds of Ku Klux Klan members from North and South Carolina gathered at the jail, dragged the men out, and killed them. Those lynchings ushered the beginning of Jim Crow in South Carolina and terrorized black communities into silence.
Fear that other members of the African American community would face the same fate as these men was probably a prominent reason many people stopped participating or really fighting for their rights.
Stephanie Cohen is a park interpreter at the Rose Hill Plantation State Historic Site, about 70 miles northeast of Columbia, the state capital.
But with everything, you have to take into account the risk. Voting was a huge risk back then. You could be murdered for just trying to vote if you were African American. Other things like sending your children to school, just speaking out of an unfair contract could result in your death if you were African American.
Episode 1 also covered the time during Reconstruction when children of formerly enslaved Africans across South Carolina's Low Country went to school at places like the Penn School on St. Helena Island and in Mitchellville in Beaufort County. And legislation during Reconstruction by one of the first black state lawmakers, Robert Smalls, established the state's public school system.
A pivotal contribution of the Reconstruction era was setting the foundation for many of the historically black colleges and universities.
That's Bobby Donaldson, director of the Center for Civil Rights History and Research at the University of South Carolina. Black children who received an education during Reconstruction soon found themselves banned from entering colleges and universities. This led to a rise of the state's historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, that started during the 1870s.
And in South Carolina, several of the schools have their roots during the Reconstruction period, including schools that helped to shape some of these civil rights activists, including Claflin University in Orangeburg, and including Allen University and Benedict College in Columbia.
Nearly a century later, in the early 1960s, many students attending HBCUs protested in the streets and at lunch counters, and were the driving force behind the civil rights movement in South Carolina.
These are young men and women who are part of what some have described as the Emmett Till generation. They are aware of the profound inequities, but they are also mindful that they can be agents of change. They are mindful that their parents are already sort of conditioned that some things may be as they are and should be left well enough alone. But they did not believe that.
This is a South Carolina Legacy of Courage podcast, a series where historians and experts help us explore some of the most significant events of African American history that happened in the state. You'll also hear the real stories of people who were there and who made a difference, and why what took place in South Carolina then is still so relevant today. This is a second of three podcast episodes, and we'll be learning here about some of the pivotal legal challenges rooted in South Carolina that made a significant difference in the entire civil rights movement. The 1950s was a time when Americans were getting in their cars and exploring the country on newly built highways.
Good times galore in your new Chevrolet. The big buy in the low price field will win in any test. All point by point comparison shows Chevy leads the rest.
This included black travelers who had to be careful about where they stopped, especially in the South. Segregation was a law, and many towns, called sundown towns, banned African Americans from being out at night.
You've got a situation where, depending on what part of the South you might be in, you may run into Klan gatherings. You may run into individuals who are just not big fans of Black folks traveling through what they deemed their territory.
Ramon Jackson is a history professor at Newberry College. It was impossible for African Americans to travel anywhere in America without fear of discrimination or violence. So in 1936, Victor Hugo Green, a New York City postal worker, created the Negro Motorist Green Book, letting travelers know where it was safe to stop. By the 1940s, there were entries for all 50 states, and Green filled its pages by tapping into a network that collected locations from residents in cities and rural towns.
The Green Book had a wide circulation, but it wasn't always as accurate as folks believe it was. Again, you're operating off of the suggestions of folks who are willing to write letters or share information via the grapevine or, you know, word of mouth. So, you know, year to year, the Green Book wasn't always a kind of perfect tool for travelers to use. There are stretches throughout its publication history where it's basically the same information from the previous year with some new articles and information kind of wrapped around it.
South Carolina's pages offered 200 listings by the 1940s, where travelers could get gas, have a meal, or stay the night. These safe places were usually owned by African Americans.
So you had barbershops, nightclubs, restaurants, tourist homes, kind of World War I, World War II veterans coming back home, taking advantage of what opportunity they had to establish businesses for themselves and feed their families and help travelers as they're moving through some rather dangerous parts of the state.
One of those businesses was Motel Simbeth, just outside of Columbia, the state capital. It was owned by civil rights activist Modjeska Monteith Simpkins. She's been described as a matriarch of the civil rights movement in South Carolina.
She was from a well-to-do family in terms of African Americans in the city, and she owned several businesses which allowed her financial independence in ways that maybe teachers and others in the Black community weren't able to achieve.
The Motel Simbeth was listed in the Green Book from 1956 to 1961. Painted in white, the main building and surrounding cabins sat just off the road, under pine trees. Its motto, rest for the weary, on this side of the Jordan.
But this was kind of one of the only motels in the city where African Americans could visit, lay their heads, be treated with dignity before moving on to other parts of the state or outside the region.
The Green Book provided both a means of survival for travelers and a steady flow of customers for the Black-owned businesses featured in the guide. The Green Book was an economic boom for Black women like Simpkins. As Jackson discovered in his research, they owned a majority of the businesses listed for South Carolina.
And many of these women were teachers or hairdressers, and they might own a tourist home on the side to bring in some extra money for their family. So there are numerous examples across the state of Black women who ran these businesses well, made a small fortune for their families, and really staked a claim for themselves as entrepreneurs during a time where that may have been frowned upon because of gender norms and values.
Then in 1964, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. Cities and towns started to desegregate. Fulfilling the hopes of its founder, Victor Green, the Negro Motorist Green Book became more and more obsolete, ending a few years later with the 1966 to 1967 guide. Decades after that last edition, many current-day owners of businesses listed in the Green Book didn't realize that their family's past is connected to the guide's role in history.
One of the things that struck me when we started doing this research is that a lot of people don't even really remember the Green Book. They know that the listing exists. They know that their parents would advertise in guides like this. But for many of these proprietors, I think it's more about their family and having a sense of pride in the fact that they were able to be financially independent, own a business for themselves, and serve their community in ways that mattered.
Taking a pause here to say that if you're interested in following South Carolina's legacy of courage, go to sclegacyofcourage.com. where you will find stories and information on this history. There's also a link there to the popular Green Book of SC.com, an online travel guide of more than 400 African-American historic sites. Or you can visit civilrightstrail.com. It's a great way to begin planning your trip. Okay, back to the story. In Clarendon County, South Carolina, in the 1950s, segregation was being enforced through violence and intimidation. At the same time, there were other forces at work in the African-American community.
There had been men who had been in the First World War. There were men who had just recently returned from the Second World War. There was the NAACP that had established a branch in South Carolina in the early 40s. There were lawsuits that were going on for people to be accepted into law schools. Teachers were suing for a better salary, and the Jim Crow business was just getting worse and worse. So all of these things were going on at one time.
Ophelia Delane Gona was a teen in the early 1950s. Her mother was a school teacher. Her father, Joseph A. Delane, was a pastor and school principal. One of the few African-American men in South Carolina with a bachelor's degree.
My father had a small church, and he was principal of a small school. He also had a farm. He was a pastor. He was a teacher. He was a leader.
As a leader, he organized parents to demand for improved school conditions in Clarendon County. At first, they petitioned for a bus, so their kids didn't have to walk 7 to 8 miles one way, while white children rode a bus to school. That lawsuit was rejected. Next, local attorney Harold Boulware and NAACP attorney Thurgood Marshall sued again, focusing on the condition of the schools. Many of the schools for black students were small wooden structures, some without indoor plumbing. Reverend Delane organized a petition demanding facilities to be, quote, equal in all respects to that which is being provided to whites. And on a November night in 1949, when the NAACP came to gather signatures, Gona says her father made a snap decision.
But at the last minute, he asked the neighbor that lived behind us if he could use his house as a place to sign up. We lived directly across the street from the school. We lived the same distance from the church, and the man who lived behind us was just a couple of hundred yards behind. That happened to be Harry Briggs' house. Harry Briggs was not at home. His wife said, "Sure, Reverend, you can use our house." Harry Briggs came home from work. His wife told him, "Reverend Delane asked us if we could use our house." Harry Briggs said, "Sure." He said, "Where's that paper? Let me sign it." So Harry Briggs' name was the first that was on the petition. His wife said, "Okay, I'll sign too." So she signed, and she was the second on the petition.
Months later, in 1950, the case known as Briggs versus Elliott went before a U.S. district court seeking facilities and opportunities equal to white students. Vernon Burton is a history professor at Clemson University.
It really wasn't a challenge against segregation. It was a challenge for equalization to begin with.
The three-judge panel denied the request, but one of them, Judge Julius Waties Waring, dissented, arguing that segregation was unequal. Waring's dissent and the arguments behind the Briggs case would go on to inform the landmark case, Brown versus Board of Education, which ended the segregation of public schools in 1954. As the Briggs case was folded in with other cases to create Brown versus Board of Education, Judge Waring, Reverend Delane, and the plaintiffs in the Briggs case were paying the price for their role in the lawsuit. The backlash against Judge Waring and his wife forced them out of South Carolina. Harry Briggs, the first to sign the petition, lost his job and also had to leave the state.
One man, Lee Richardson, he was forced off the land and he had to move someplace else. Mary Oliver was the owner of a cafe, and they had difficulty in buying supplies for the cafe. My father lost his job.
His church was burned.
Burton picks up the story about Reverend Delane.
When the Klan and others and Knight Riders attacked him, the police told him to mark the car, so when they came shooting at his house, he shot back, and they put out a warrant for his arrest. And so he had to escape South Carolina and literally got in the trunk of a car and went to New York.
So that one of the chief supporters of my father and that helped to get the lawsuit going was Reverend Seals. He also was a teacher and a preacher. His wife was a teacher also. And he taught both elementary school and classes to the returned veterans. So both of those teaching jobs he was fired from. His wife was fired. Three of my aunts altogether were fired.
Remember the civil rights leader, Mo Jessica Simpkins, who owned the Motel Simbeth listed in the Green Book? She worked with Delane on drafting up the petition. And later, when almost everyone involved with the case lost their jobs, her niece, Henri Monteith Treadwell, says Simpkins collected donations from across the country to help those families in Clarendon County.
You can look at the school desegregation lawsuits across the nation that started in South Carolina. As a child, I know my aunt would bring out to the home boxes of clothing, boxes of food that they got from the North for us to separate and put in appropriate piles so that they could be delivered to people in Clarendon County.
Although the Briggs case would fade into the background of Brown versus Board of Education, historian Vernon Burton says this fight for equality in rural South Carolina informed not just the Brown case, but the Civil Rights Act that came a decade later, and in every fight for equality thereafter. One summer morning, in June of 1954, Sarah Mae Fleming stepped onto a bus in Columbia, South Carolina. She was headed to her job as a maid for a wealthy white family living in the suburbs of the state capital. She was just 20 years old, and as she boarded the bus, she noted where the white passengers were sitting. As being black, she was required to sit behind the so-called line that divided black and white passengers. Black passengers had to sit behind the white ones, and so the line that separated them constantly shifted as white passengers got on and off the bus. Christopher Freer is a researcher with the Center for Civil Rights History and Research.
When she and Julia Elizabeth King, her friend, stepped onto the rear door, they had to stand in the aisle. A white woman rang the bell on the bus to get up at the next stop, just a block into Sarah Mae Fleming's ride. The white woman got up, so Sarah Mae Fleming moved forward because there was not a white woman beside that seat. So it was an empty row now. So she moved to sit down.
That's when the bus driver noticed her in his rear view mirror, then shouted at her to get out of her seat. Flustered and embarrassed, Fleming got up, pulled the bell to leave the bus, and headed toward the front, not the back.
When she attempted to go forward to get off the bus from the front entrance, the bus driver balled his hand, made a fist, and swung his arm back to stop her, to block her path, and struck her with his elbow in her midsection, doubling her over.
Bus drivers in South Carolina at the time were considered agents of the law, and the bus line was owned by South Carolina Electric and Gas. The bus driver's blow knocked Fleming backwards. Her friend caught her and helped her off the bus. Another rider saw what happened and immediately called Mo Jessica Simpkins, the civil rights powerhouse who earlier worked on the Briggs versus Elliott case. Again, Bobby Donaldson from the University of South Carolina.
Ms. Simpkins puts her in contact with a local lawyer who had been sympathetic on previous occasions to African-American clients. His name was Philip Wittenberg, and it is Philip Wittenberg who sets the stage of a lawsuit that becomes Fleming versus SCENG, where she challenges the enforced racial segregation on the buses of Columbia, South Carolina.
The Supreme Court had just ruled on Brown versus Board of Education a few months earlier, and Simpkins saw an opportunity to build a case around what happened to Sarah Mae Fleming and create another opportunity to define the 14th Amendment, giving equal rights to African Americans. The case, Fleming versus South Carolina Electric and Gas, traveled through the courts before it could make an impact on where Black passengers could sit on city buses. The case spent the next year in the courts, ending up in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. That court ruled that segregation on public transportation was unconstitutional. South Carolina Electric and Gas then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they denied the request to hear it. Meanwhile, four women involved in the Montgomery bus boycott filed a similar federal civil rights lawsuit against that city. As Sarah Mae Fleming waited for her trial in South Carolina, the Alabama federal court took on the Montgomery bus boycott case. The Alabama court looked at the Fourth Circuit Court's ruling in Fleming's case and ruled that Montgomery could no longer segregate passengers on buses. In late 1956, the Supreme Court affirmed that ruling, ending segregation on city buses. Sarah Mae Fleming stood by her case as it moved from one judge to the next. After its journey through the courts, Allen University students rode buses throughout Columbia to test Fleming's case and found that they could sit anywhere on the bus. But those who knew Sarah Mae Fleming said she was disappointed that the impact of her case was not felt sooner.
And she said the following. She said, "What I did, I believe it was the right thing to do. I hope it does not cause too much trouble." And so Sarah Mae Fleming did not fully realize that she was setting the stage for many other young men and women. What they were doing was the right thing to do, but it caused all kinds of trouble.
The young people Sarah Mae Fleming set the stage for included the nearly 200 students who protested at the South Carolina Capitol in March of 1961. The high school and HBCU students came from across the state.
These were young people, many of whom had been involved in protests and demonstrations across the state over the prior year. They were marching in part because they were dissatisfied. They were dissatisfied by the lack of response of state leaders to their efforts to desegregate lunch counters, bus stations, restaurants, hotels.
The students walked in single and double file holding signs, many of them trained for the nonviolent protest. One of them was U.S. Congressman Jim Clyburn, who has represented South Carolina since 1993.
I had decided that day, though, that I was a little bit tired of going in and out of jail, so I decided on that particular day I would come over to Columbia, help them get organized. But I was not going to march that day. And that was my intention until I got to the church.
When Clyburn arrived at the Zion Baptist Church, he met up with NAACP field director, Reverend Isaiah DeQuincy Newman.
So I told him that I was not going to march that day. I just came over to help get organized, but I had to study. So I was going back to the campus. Now, he knew I might go back to the campus, but he knew studying wasn't on my agenda.
Reverend Newman knew that not only was Clyburn going to march that day, but by taking one look at what Clyburn was wearing, he knew Clyburn was prepared to go to jail.
And he knew that when we were planning to spend time in jail, we had a certain dress we would have. You certainly would have a three-piece olive green suit like I had on that day, gold shirt with a paisley tie.
Clyburn marched with the others toward the state capitol, where they stood out front until police told them that's as far as they could go. Again, Bobby Donaldson, director of the Center for Civil Rights History and Research at the University of South Carolina.
When they get to the grounds of the State House, they're told they could march around the grounds for 15 minutes in silence, and then they are to go back to their place of worship. Well, something happened in the course of those 15 minutes where the students decided they were not going to go directly back to the State House, and they were not going to go back in silence. Many people say that Reverend David Carter started preaching while he was on the grounds of the State House. And he said to the students, if you want your freedom, you need to say so. And they respond in kind. And they begin singing and dancing around the State House. And as they are doing so, they are being followed by police.
Then the police moved in, arresting 187 students and charging them for violating a breach of the peace.
No one did anything. No one said anything. Nobody provoked to do anything. It was just the Chief Strom decided that this was as much marching as he was going to tolerate as the chief law enforcement officer in the state.
Clyburn often works out of his congressional office near the state capitol in Columbia, and he's quick to note that it's one block from where he was arrested that day. A lawsuit was filed claiming the arrest violated the students' First Amendment rights, protecting their freedom of speech, assembly, and petitioning of the government. The case, Edwards versus South Carolina, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And, in an 8-1 landmark decision, the court ruled that the state had violated the students' First Amendment rights, protected under the 14th Amendment. The impact this march had on the civil rights movement may not be as well known as other key moments and people in the civil rights movement, but the courage and sacrifice shown in South Carolina laid the groundwork for future protests and legal challenges that elevated equal rights for all. Coming up on the next episode of the podcast.
The end of segregation, they were not going to be satisfied with, quote, the crumbs of citizenship while others enjoy the whole loaf, unquote. So he's really making it plain and making it clear that the end of Jim Crow is at hand. And if it doesn't come through law, the potency of public protest would definitely bring those walls down.
After listening to the podcast, learn more about the sites of the South Carolina Legacy of Courage. For example, see where the protests took place at the state capitol and where Sarah Mae Fleming boarded the bus in Columbia. You can visit a statue of Judge Julius Waties Waring in Charleston and historic markers at the homes and churches where planning meetings were held for Briggs versus Elliott. Go to sclegacyofcourage.com, greenbookofsc.com, or civilrightstrail.com to begin planning your trip. In this episode, we heard from Stephanie Cohen, Bobby Donaldson, Ramon Jackson, Ophelia Delane Gona, Vernon Burton, Henri Monteith Treadwell, and Christopher Freer and Congressman Jim Clyburn. I'm Marlene Gordon. The South Carolina Legacy of Courage podcast is sponsored by Discover South Carolina. The series was produced by Ingredient Creative with Tanner Latham as executive producer and Catherine Welch as the writer. Elliot Majerzik edited and mixed the sound, and research was provided by Archival Ninjas.